future episodes of Muslim Lady. But the important topic that I think we're going to start off with today is regarding the value of having children and child upbringing and the identity of being a mother. Especially in today's age, I feel that being a mother is so degrading for some women in society, and they feel so ashamed among their peers to say that, oh, I'm a housewife, or oh, I'm a stay-at-home mom. They feel like, well, their life is useless and their existence is useless and they don't know what they're doing with themselves and they don't have that sense of identity anymore. So if we can explain the innate value that's actually interwoven with being a mom and how valuable that is and how valuable it is to raise a child and how hard it is.
Yeah.
I'd really appreciate that.
First of all, well, yeah, what you were saying is absolutely correct. And it's unfortunate and very sad to see that, you know, the people out there, the mothers feel ashamed of saying that, you know, we are housewives, not thinking about the fact that their task and duty is like 24 hours,
exactly.
I feel, right? Even they have to take care of how their children fall off to sleep. So in a nutshell, parenting is the process of promoting and supporting their physical, the children's physical, emotional, social, intellectual, and spiritual development of a child from infancy to adulthood. So it's like an ongoing process, you know, and you have to look at all aspects, not only one aspect. People are very smart in doing the worldly bit, you know, providing for the children in the best possible ways and intellectually also giving the best schools to them.
Education.
And sometimes they lag behind the spiritual aspect and they don't give the religion to them, thinking that they will learn slowly. They'll be matured and learn. But that requires to be ingrained in a very young age so that they can show the fruits later on. As followers of a divinely revealed religion, that is Islam, we appreciate the fact that all of these areas of promotion and support must take place within the legal framework of the teachings of the Quran and the tradition of the Prophet and the Aima alayhi salam. So it's not very, you know, it's not a simple task. And it might be like, okay, now we want to make our family larger to bring up 2, 3, 4 kids. No, you have to think about the fact that how to upbring them. That's very important. So this is not enough at all. You know, like we say that the more the better in the in Islam. And it is encouraged, in fact. But with the condition that you have to know that you have the capacity to bring them up in that way. If you know that you just can't bring them up in this way regarding all the aspects, and you know that you won't get support from probably your spouse, then you have to like think about the process of, you know, family planning. Maybe 2 kids, 3 kids, but the more the better still.
Because in that case, it's really not fair on the child either, is it?
Yeah, it's not
fair
on
the
child.
For you to bring a child into this world whom you cannot properly support and raise, and they're just going to end up having been deprived of many of the fundamental needs. It's just so sad, isn't it?
Yeah. But the thing is, one thing we should bear in mind, that as far as the sustenance is concerned, it's from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And when sustenance is mentioned, it's mentioned in every aspect. So the parents should know that, you know, like when I want a child, it's within the innate nature of a parent, of a family, to think about bringing up children in life, in this world. So they should know that the such sustenance is ready for them. As far as the financial sustenance, the spiritual sustenance, all it requires is to take a step forward and do something about it. And Allah will, of course, give a lot of blessings in the process, inshallah. So what are the requirements of parenting first? To know the value of parenting. Let's see of what are the requirements of parenting. We see that there are 3 prime areas which parents and guardians need to ensure that they look after when they take on this great responsibility of working with the children and to make them the best human beings possible in the earth and the future leaders of Islam. And that's how, you know, that dua that we recite in kunut. Rabbana hablana min azwajina wa dhurriyatina qurrata a'yuni waj'alna lil muttaqina imama. And that's what our aim should be, to make them leaders of the muttaqin. That's a very big aim, you know, it's a very high aim, because we want to bring children who are pious, but leaders of the pious.
Yeah,
so they are the more pious than the pious also. So this should be our aim. So it's a great responsibility, and there are requirements for this. And the first is the physical security and development of a child. This is the requirement. What is this talking about? The safety of a children's body and his life, that security that he should get. It's not that, like, for example, if a mother is sick, for example, she's facing so much sickness and she can't handle herself also. She knows that she won't be able to provide that safety. You see, as a child is growing up, he needs to be taken care of every step, you know, like a toddler.
Yes.
You need to go after him. So if the mother is physically handicapped, she knows that she can't, unless she has the means, you know, around her. For example, some support, some kind of help to take care of a child. So that becomes a very special thing for her also. So it goes without saying that all people need to have safety and security. And of course, young children more so. So we see the nations spend so much, you know, time and money to ensure this safety and well-being for citizens to be maintained. Like, for example, when this disease of corona had come about, how much was spent, you know, to maintain that safety and security, the bodily security?
Yeah.
So many hospitals were being rebuilt, and I don't know, areas were being taken on for this kind of venture.
Yes.
And so much money was spent, and, you know, like research on vaccines and so forth. And I guess still now it might be going on. So the safety, physical safety, is very important for one. And that's why, because, you see, this is prime importance, and I mentioned it first, is because we as human beings are more acquainted to the nature part of the world, the tabi'ah, you know, like our five senses and our zahir. We yearn for these kind of requirements more than when we spiritually grow. You see, it takes a kind of a spiritual maturity to come and understand the religion and the, you know, the aqidah of Islam. Well,
ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Muslim Lady. We are going to go for a short break, so stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. This is Muslim Lady. I'm joined in the studio by Sister Salma Khalfan, and we are talking about the mother's identity and the value of child upbringing. Sister Salma, I think that in a lot of cases, the more complex, the more contributing the task we have at hand is, and the more physical, psychological and intellectual effort we have to exert in order to fulfill that task, the more valuable it becomes, right?
Absolutely.
And obviously, there is nothing in this world more valuable than the human life, right? As the Quran states that if you take one human life, it's like you've taken all of it. If you save one human life, it's like you've saved all of humanity. And even if we want to look at it from like an evolutionary aspect, we are the most evolved of all living creatures. We are the most complex of all living creatures, most intelligent, so on and so forth. So it's really still so strange for me to understand how is it that the identity of a mother is robbed from her because raising a child has been looked at as something so trivial and insignificant. When it's like she's literally determining the future of humanity, right? By what she's doing.
That's right. Absolutely. Actually, you know what? Sometimes it's a wrong influence that touches her through the media and people around her, her peers.
Yeah.
So she loses the interest in what she really yearned for in the first place. Her fitrat, you know, kind of gets covered. Because if you go and see a mother enhances so much, you know, of her existence, her wujud. First of all, her time. Her time is, like, everybody's time is so valuable for them, right? Like, we yearn for our space and we want that, you know, time and space to do our things. But a mother, look at her self-sacrifice.
She's consumed.
She's just, you know, so engrossed in bringing up her child that she wants to not only give her time, that is a real parent I'm talking about and a valuable parent, her, you know, like, quality time. You'll see she's trying to find out how to do things with her child so that the child can be healthily, you know, grown up in a perfect state of mind, play with her child, find new items to intellectually grow, you know, her child. And she's doing it with interest too. And those are the real parents out there who do this, the Islamic parents. And you can find these also who are so interested and they don't take, you know, like any influence. Nothing influences them. Whoever tells them whatever, and even if they have so many degrees at hand, they will give up that and they will do what they have to do and they yearn to do and they feel like doing. Which is, it's such a beautiful job if you go and see, like out there we have to struggle and to, you know, to do something and then to work and to come back home and to toil and you get your, you know, like you're some payment at the end of the month or something, or the end of the week. But here a parent has everything ready at hand. That right thoughts, that emotionality, that sustenance promised by Allah, those sawabs ready for her to take care of Allah's amanat. You know, so everything is there and that interest to do it and that love. You know, and that's so amazing. It's not as if that, you know, she has to do it and she yearns and loves to do it.
Right.
So time is very important factor, you know, to give the proper time, the quality time. And that's when, you know, we sometimes really stress the men, the spouses, their, you know, their husbands, to also give quality time to the children.
Because
the two parents together make a healthy child, you know.
That's very important. You're right. And that's definitely something we're going to touch upon in further episodes of Muslim Lady. But that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so very much for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, so Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A 21-gun salute was performed in the honor of the Iranian president as Oman's Sultan Haitham bin Tariq received Ebrahim Raisi, who was on a one-day visit to the Persian Gulf country. The high-ranking delegations representing the two countries held discussions before the meeting between the two heads of state was held. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, was also among the high-ranking delegation. He met with his Omani counterpart, Saeed Badr al-Busaidi, on Monday. The Iranian president said dialogue and cooperation among regional nations would create security, noting that the presence of foreign forces not only won't serve to secure the region, but will threaten peace too.
I think first and foremost, it's important to highlight that it's significant that the first visit for the Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, to the to the neighboring countries is to Oman. Oman is renowned as the Switzerland, if you like, of the region, a country that enjoys good ties with everyone, a country that tries to stay neutral, a country that tries to be the facilitator and mediator in a number of contentious issues. And Oman has strived to maintain these ties, whether it's with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with UAE, with Qatar, across the entire spectrum. And this is what leads many to believe that this visit by Iran to Oman is testament to, of course, one, to this ability of Gulf states to have good ties with Iran, and two, as a model through which Gulf states can have ties with Iran and which Iran can have ties with Gulf states, a relationship that respects the integrity of one another, and in a relationship that boosts economic ties, and a relationship that tries to promote dialogue first and foremost, as opposed to trying to settle scores.
Ebrahim Raisi further welcomed what he called Tehran and Muscat's remarkably similar stance on a multitude of matters. The Iranian president hailed the visit as one that opened a new chapter in the bilateral relations between Iran and Oman. An Iranian delegation of 50 tradesmen and economic operators traveled to Oman last week in order to pave the way for the development of economic and trade ties between the two friendly countries. Iranian Minister of Road and Urban Development, Rostam Kassemi, announced that Oman and Iran are going to sign a transportation agreement in order to establish a joint shipping line and tourist flights between the two countries. The two sides signed 13 documents and memoranda of understanding in such fields as energy, politics, transportation, diplomacy, economy, tourism, sports, and the environment. Oman is also seeking to import gas from Iran by building an offshore pipeline between the two nations.
Renew Iranian access to the global economy. And part of that, or part of the Iranian considerations, is to find a reliable partner that it trusts in order to help to facilitate that re-access or rehabilitation into the international markets. And Oman being a country that is particularly trusted by Iran, that has good ties with Iran, that has proven time and time again, or rather this relationship has proven time and time again, to be a steady relationship between Oman and Iran. Iran wants to utilize Oman's unique position in the region, not just in terms of its strategic location, but also with regards to its international free trade agreements, with which Oman enjoys even with the likes of the United States. The idea being that Oman is a good hub through which to essentially propel Iranian goods or Iranian businesses or Iranian investments, or even to receive investments from abroad via Oman, via a trusted partner.
Iran and Oman have agreed to form a committee to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, which straddles both countries' sea borders. In 2005, both countries signed a memorandum of understanding to jointly develop the Hengam oil field, but the agreement did not materialize. This is why the Iranian president said the trip marked a departure, as the documents and memorandum of understanding will be implemented this time.
The Labour victory ends nearly a decade of Conservative rule in Australia. Minister Scott Morrison conceded defeat after an election on Saturday, and the opposition Labour Party was set to end almost a decade of Conservative rule, possibly with the support of pro-environment independents. Anthony Albanese says he wants to make Australia greener and less hawkish. He said he wanted to unite the country. He told his supporters, "I think people want to come together. Look for our common interest, look towards that sense of common purpose. I think people have had enough of division. What they want is to come together as a nation, and I intend to lead that." Labour has secured a parliamentary majority in general elections, but Albanese may still need a coalition partner to rule. He has indicated that they'll be picked from like-minded independents. The new Labour government promises to reset Australia's relations with the world. Albanese has also promised to create stronger ties with Asia. He said, "We live in a region whereby in the future we will have China, India, and Indonesia as giants. We need to strengthen that economic partnership, and one way that we can do that is by strengthening people-to-people relations as well." Labour has promised more financial assistance and a robust social safety net as Australia grapples with the highest inflation since 2001 and soaring housing prices. The party also plans to increase minimum wages. Others will be watching closely to see if Albanese's premiership brings a less hawkish tone on China, and whether ministerial meetings with Beijing resumes after a more than two-year hiatus. On the foreign policy front, it has proposed to establish a Pacific Defense School to train neighboring armies in response to China's potential military presence on the Solomon Islands. In late April, the Solomon Islands signed a security pact with China. The outgoing Australian leader was highly critical of China in particular and Asian countries in general. He had earlier accused his main opponent of being Beijing's preferred candidate. Relations between China and Australia have strained since 2018, when Australia became the first country to ban the Chinese telecom giant Huawei from its 5G wireless networks. Australia has long been known as the lucky country, partly due to its wealth of coal and gas, as well as minerals like iron ore, which have driven generations of economic growth. But it's now sitting on the frontier of a climate crisis, and the fires, floods, and droughts that are expected to become more extreme due to the rising global temperatures. Labour wants to tackle climate change with an ambitious 43% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2030. It also has pledged to reach emission net zero by 2050, partly by strengthening the mechanism used to pressure companies to make cuts. To speed up the transition to renewable energy, Labour plans to modernise Australia's energy grid and roll out solar banks and community batteries. But despite its net zero commitment, Labour says it'll approve new coal projects if they're environmentally and economically viable. The Conservative government had been called a climate holdout by the United Nations Secretary General after outlining a plan to get to net zero by 2050 by creating massive new gas projects. Incumbent Scott Morrison had said he would back a transition from coal to renewable energy, but had no plans to stop new coal projects.
Oh, the legacy is awful. We have the worst climate change policies on the planet, courtesy of this government. They were promoting new coal mines. A huge part of their argument was we had to open up more mines as fast as possible. So it was, you know, crashing headlong into climate change and denying any role in it. Foreign policy was a joke.
Elena Doohan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights, who was on a mission to Iran from May 7th to 18th, has described U.S. sanctions on Iran as unjustifiable and inhumane.
Iran has been subjected to a broad scope of unilateral sanctions for a long period of time already. In particular, the United States has imposed economic, trade, and financial sanctions on Iran since the late 1970s, with a comprehensive trade ban since 1995, and measures to isolate Iran from the international commercial and financial system. These were expanded in mid-2000, and again after 2010, extending to many economic sectors.
U.S. sanctions also targeted Iran's central bank as well as commercial banks. The EU adopted restrictive measures and comprehensive economic and trade sanctions against Iran in 2010, supplemented by an oil embargo in 2012, and trade prohibitions involving key sectors and the freezing of assets of the Iranian central bank, Iranian shipping and shipbuilding sector, and a number of persons and entities, and restrictions on financial services, as well as exports and imports. In May 2018, Washington unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, under which the international sanctions on the Islamic Republic were eased in exchange for Tehran putting limitations on certain aspects of its nuclear activities. The U.S. then reinstated harsh economic sanctions on Iran and slapped new ones that barred countries and international firms from working with Tehran. Doohan said the U.S. continues to ban trade and investment in Iran, forcing foreign companies to leave the country for the fear of sanctions. Many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical and medical companies around the world, overcomply with sanctions out of fear of potential penalties. The UN rapporteur stated that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip Iranians of their basic rights to health. The top UN human rights official highlighted that applying extraterritorial sanctions on Iranian companies or companies working with Iran is illegal under international law. Doohan added that the sanctions have also hampered Iran's effort to import life-saving medicines due to restrictions on banking transactions.
Human rights in Iran are severely affected by the use of unilateral sanctions. The most close to every single individual's fear is the sphere of health. The situation in Iran is the following: that some medicines are produced domestically, at the same time the raw materials are imported. And then it comes the issue again of payments, deliveries, the quality of delivered raw materials. When it comes to the rare or severe diseases, there is no possibility to deliver that.
Commenting on Iran's frozen assets abroad, the UN official said the assets estimated to be around $120 billion need to be unblocked. Doohan began her 11-day visit to Iran on May 7th, a day before the fourth anniversary of the U.S. illegal withdrawal from the JCPOA. She also referred to stalled negotiations in Vienna to bring the U.S. back to the JCPOA, urging the signatories and the U.S. to resume the negotiations. In the end, Duhan called on sanctioning states, the US in particular, to abandon their policy of maximum pressure against Iran and other countries. Economic sanctions are the policy tool of choice for the United States to force countries to bend if they don't follow Washington's foreign policy objectives in many cases. Yet they have failed to bring the desired result, as they might generate some meaningful behavioral change in the targeted or sanctioned country about 40% of time.
We know that sanctions really don't work as far as convincing or having leaderships of different countries change their decision making or their behavior. So I think over the years we've learned that nothing's going to change with the continued sanctions.
Unilateral sanctions have endangered the humanitarian situation and people's livelihood in Iran, while further affecting the vulnerable strata of the society. In sanctioned countries like Iran, Venezuela, Cuba, Syria, and Yemen, medical equipment is rather outdated, and they suffer shortages of medicine and protective means. One of the reasons is that payment systems are not available to buy and have medicine enter the respective countries. For instance, Iran was the scene of a serious economic and health crisis, hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic. The embargo put in place by the United States threatened the lives of many Iranians. In what has been termed economic terrorism, Washington attempts to use sanctions as a leverage to overthrow the legitimate governments of other countries, something it has done in the case of Venezuela and Cuba. Whether direct or indirect, most of the U.S. sanctions are not authorized by the United Nations Security Council, and many of them are imposed unilaterally by Washington. In fact, more than two-thirds of the world's countries officially condemn U.S. sanctions as a blatant violation of international law and the UN Charter.
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February. As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
In the limelight.
Now we better understand why the terrorist cliques in the U.S. and in the Zionist entity desperately target and kill such inspirational figures of the Islamic Revolution. As commander of the 41st Thar Allah Brigade during the liberation of Khorramshahr, Qasem Soleimani in January 2020 in Baghdad, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading Beitul Muqaddas Operations Liberating Role Despite Terrorism. Stay tuned for more. Years ago, when Operation Beitul Muqaddas triumphed in freeing the port city of Khorramshahr from the occupation of Saddam's tyrannical Ba'ath minority regime, there were shockwaves not just in Baghdad but also in Tel Aviv and Washington because of the indomitable spirit of resistance of the Iranian people and the code name of their campaign, which referred to the Zionist usurped Islamic State. The Triangle of Evil, which until now was confident of slowly leading to death the Islamic Republic and turning the Iraqi-occupied parts of Iran into a sort of Palestinian territories or Kashmir that will never be resolved through any negotiations, began to hatch intricate plots in an attempt to avert the inevitable. Saudi Arabia, as the principal bankroller of Saddam's persecution of Iraq Shia Muslim majority and the ethno-sectarian war imposed on Iran, was also a bit shaken by the liberation of Khorramshahr. King Khalid bin Abdulaziz, the blinded bigot that he was, sent a congratulatory cable to Saddam that read, "Do not grieve at the loss of some 35,000 killed or captured mostly Iraqi Shia soldiers." The U.S. and the Zionist regime resorted to organized terrorism against Iran, including supply of internationally banned chemical weapons to Saddam and open support for the MKO hypocrites, whose ringleaders were soon shifted from France to Iraq due to fears that Iranian victories on the battlefields would end Ba'athist rule in Baghdad, thereby opening the path towards the Golan Heights and the borders of occupied Palestine, in view of the Islamic Republic's already strong ties with Syria and the people of Lebanon. The first step of the enemies in this regard was the targeted kidnapping by the pro-Israel Falangist militia in July 1982 of Ahmad Motawassalian, the commander of the Muhammad Rasulullah Brigade during the Beitul Muqaddas operations that liberated Khorramshahr, who was serving as defense attaché at the Iranian embassy in Lebanon. Motawassalian and his three companions in the car bearing diplomatic plate, Charge d'affaires Sayed Mohsen Mousavi, embassy technician Taghi Rastegar Muqaddam, and journalist Kazem Akhavan, were transferred to the Zionist entity by their terrorist captors led by the now deceased Ili Hubeika and Samir Giga, recently elected to the Lebanese parliament, who is on record as saying the Iranian diplomats were murdered. Today, Saddam and his Ba'athist clique have long been cast into the dustbin of history. The MKO hypocrites have fled to Europe in disgrace, and Iraq is now part of the growing Islamic resistance movement, which has emerged as a solid chain stretching from Iran to the Levantine coast of the Mediterranean Sea. All this means that the epic liberation of Khorramshahr exactly 40 years ago, due to the national unity and religious solidarity of the Iranian people, in spite of their being constantly targeted by terrorists in Washington and Tel Aviv, is a firm indication that Operation Beitul Muqaddas did not end on May 24, 1982, but is firmly on its way towards the city of Beitul Muqaddas and the cherished goal of the liberation of Palestine. Now we better understand why the terrorist cliques in the U.S. and in the Zionist entity desperately target and kill such inspirational figures of the Islamic Revolution as commander of the 41st Thar Allah Brigade during the liberation of Khorramshahr, Qasem Soleimani, in January 2020 in Baghdad. The latest victim of this spate of terrorism is Colonel Hassan Sayyad Khodayi of the IRGC division of the Defenders of the Holy Shrines, who attained martyrdom in Tehran on last Sunday, May 22nd, as a result of a cowardly attack by Zionist regime agents. Vengeance is part of the liberating spirit of the Beitul Muqaddas operations, and God willing, we'll soon see the dastardly terrorists brought to justice, whether they live in the U.S. or in any other place. ¶¶
Cultural news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With delight.
Humans have disrupted the turtle survival for years due to their greed for meat, eggs, skin, and shells. But the decreasing population of the species is creating conscious of conservation. Cambodians have released hundreds of turtles of an endangered variety into the wild on World Turtle Day. About 600 Cantor's giant soft-shell turtles were let into a river in northeastern Cambodia. After people collected the species from a holding pool, Cambodian monks blessed the tiny creatures, then set them free. The Wildlife Conservation Society was the organizer of this event. It said that only a few records of Cantor turtles have remained in Laos, while they have mostly been wiped out in Vietnam and Thailand. The body has so far released over 1,500 hatchlings into the wild in 2022. The meadows in the foothills of the Swiss Alps have turned white these days, with locals calling it May snow. But it has nothing to do with snow. It's all about narcissus blooms covering the hills above the town of Montreux. Locals call the scene May snow because it looks like a blanket of snow from a distance. The flowers have been a tourist attraction since the 19th century, but factors such as urbanization have caused their decline in the past few years. Artists in a small town in the United Kingdom have created a massive bumblebee mural, hoping to raise awareness about this vanishing species. The mural was painted on the playing field of a primary school in the town of Haptonbridge. It was debuted on International Bee Day. The artist used paints typically used to draw lines for football pitches. Scientists say rising temperatures and heavy pesticide use are contributing to the decline in the number of bumblebees across Europe and North America. They say the population reduction rate is consistent with mass extinction of a species altogether. Children at a school have also created a wildflower meadow to help encourage bees to pollinate. A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's wood blocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of a thick sheet of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. Then ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryan said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.